Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Ishik, joined by Murat as always.
How's it going?
Hello. He's actually got a mic again this time around. I think we're finally coming up. It's been a while, but we're back with Our Thoughts Tonight. For Our Thoughts Tonight, it's going to be kind of a broad, or not broad, but a dual subject. Political reform and theory in reference to anywhere from politics to philosophy to psychology, basically the validity and usefulness of it. But before we get into that, as always, Crucem Sanctum. I miss Crucem Sanctum.
We are back.
All right. So, so today we have Murat, take it over.
I am here. Today, we were kind of thinking about doing a couple different subjects. We haven't exactly decided on what we want to do. We're kind of doing a little bit different of a format this evening. We've got Sean here, Sean Lyons. It's like the last episode. We've got Zach Cross here.
Hello.
Well, Zach is actually running an errand right now, but he'll be back.
Yep, and when he comes back, we do have another game, kind of a shorter than the last episode's game, but kind of the same idea. But for the actual topic tonight, it's going to mainly revolve around, I guess, political reform, but the larger thing to look at is, it's kind of hard to explain, but basically, if you really want to think about it, evidence-based proposals versus hypothetical conceptual proposals. And basically, mostly if hypothetical proposals are valid enough or can be worked around. Usually things like that are lumped into pseudoscience. But I guess it's going to be a little bit of a defense of, you know, questionable belief systems that we're usually attacking on our thoughts tonight. But yeah.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be kind of a... I think we're going to have to get into some heated debate, honestly, on that point. But before we start the game, because Zach's still running his errand, I think the question I'm going to ask everybody right now, we have Murat and Professor Sean currently. I suppose the thing is before getting into too deep of a subject, do you think that violent reform is ever justifiable? I guess as an intro to the game that we're going to do soon, but
violent reform, like a radical reform type of.
Not the ideas don't have to be radical. The ideas don't have to be radical, but just the method of violence in a, you know.
You mean blood being shed?
Yeah, but if necessary, yeah, violent reform.
I don't know. From my point of view, I was thinking about this earlier today. Kind of like the French Revolution, or any time in history that blood was shed over a political reform. And I don't know if we're okay with it now because so much time has passed and it's just the normal. But if you were okay with one system and it was overthrown, how would you feel in that moment in time? That could happen with democracy violently currently. So I wouldn't want to be on the end that supports whatever system is active. But I guess if you're on the end of the reform or revolution, I guess it doesn't matter how you get the reform to happen. As long as it's happening, that's really what matters to those people in a lot of cases.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. So my answer is relatively simple. I think that violent reform begats violent reform. And it creates a cycle of violence that continues. An example is the French Revolution. The Reign of Terror begat Napoleon, which begat 15 years of bloodshed in Europe. One could also say that the American Revolution, also violent, led eventually to the American Civil War, much more violent. And if the traitor becomes the king, or whether the traitor is hung, the traitor in turn, if he or she does become the king, then is usually hung in turn at some point. And so the cycle continues. And therefore, reformers like Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who preached nonviolence, and one could even say Jesus, not Jesus the God, but Jesus the man, also initiated a nonviolence. Although how people interpreted his nonviolent movement begat much violence. It also begat much peace, but it also begat much violence. So I think that violent reform usually begat more violence.
So can I go ahead and assume that – well, so you think under most conditions that violent reform is unattractive, I guess, in like almost all conditions?
Well, that's difficult. That's a tough question.
Yeah.
Violent reform has led to good. For instance, the French Revolution did eventually lead to a republic, even though the restoration occurred after the French Revolution. But eventually it did work, and also the American Revolution and the Civil War eventually led to, well, actually we're still struggling with this, equality of all in this country. So it has served some purpose. I'm not sure it's always justified.
Mm-hmm.
One wonders if by nonviolent means better actions would have been achieved or better results would have been achieved. For instance, Edmund Burke, the great parliamentarian, he gave a long speech at the beginning of the American Revolution in which he basically preached to Parliament that it might work on everybody's behalf to not respond to America's complaints with the military, but actually respond with some mercy and also some compromise. And one wonders if Burke had convinced Parliament not to send an army to the colonies, what that would have resulted in.
Mm-hmm. I think, so I kind of want to ask, in that sense, it's basically the government not having a violent reaction, right, in that sense?
Right.
So,
right.
Well, that makes me wonder that if that was the case, if there's a government that pretty much practiced mercy or compromise,
Or nonviolence
overall. Do you think that could be taken advantage of by people who are not part of the government, who will see the weakness in a certain government, or quote unquote weakness, I should say.
I believe you're right.
Yeah.
And there's many incidences through history where nonviolence has been, what's the term I want, has been interpreted as weakness.
Yeah.
Whereas it should be interpreted as a form of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And that has resulted in violent people taking over. One might, not that the government prior to Hitler was nonviolent, but he perceived their passivity as a weakness.
Yeah.
And allowed him to move in.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. So I think I'm going to ask a question that kind of goes for everybody. So the one thing that I've been recently witnessing with like the whole BLM stuff going on right now, I mean, it's not like some of the protests, I mean, some say they were violent, but in my opinion, I mean, basically the question is, do you think that a combined effort of violent reformers and peaceful reformers will basically force the government to compromise with the peaceful protesters, or I'm not saying protesters, but the peaceful reformers in general? Like, let's say if there are two groups of reformers, I'm kind of thinking of like the civil rights movement, right? You have like more militant activists
like Malcolm X.
But that's the extreme option, which gives us a compromise with Martin Luther, or even like Russian Revolution stuff. Like, you know, you have the extremists, the Bolsheviks, and the compromise would be like the white movement, which them themselves weren't that moderate, but that is technically like the moderate option. Of course, that didn't happen. They didn't win. But do you think having that violent outlier group forces the current government to maybe search for a middle ground, or do you think it's more times than not lumped all into one category?
Depends on how strong the other group is.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, but Bolsheviks, that's
the Bolsheviks were very strong.
Yeah. I mean, I was Yeah, I mean, Bolsheviks play their cards right, I guess. But actually, see, the Bolsheviks, I think, so I think I kind of want to get into the game really quickly because we're talking about the Bolsheviks, and in this game, there's going to be a scenario that is similar, very much similar to, I think, the Soviet Union. So here, give me one sec. Hey, Zach, you want to play this game with us?
Give me a sec.
All right. Okay. So if you guys saw the last at this game, it's pretty much everybody picks a number and they go through the scenario, right? So this scenario, these scenarios are going to be, I guess, social conditions in a country, or how the government is, really. And basically, if you think violent revolution or violent reform is preferable, or what you think is the best way for a group of people to get through that society, right? If it's through peaceful options, or if some sort of drastic measures are needed, whether it be protests, violent protests, or flat revolution, or whatever, right? So it's going to start out with, I'm going to transition this mic over to you, Murat.
How are we doing?
We're doing good.
That sounds fun.
So pretty much it's 1 through 100. Everybody pick a number. So I'm going to start with you, Sean. 1 through 100, any number. 75. Okay.
I don't want to jinx it or anything, but on the engineering end of the podcast, we sound great tonight. Knock on wood, everyone.
All right.
Oh, sorry. What was the? Can you tell me one more time?
Just 1 through 100. Pick a number.
44.
Okay. All right. Let me just yell across the room to Zach. Hey, Zach. All right. Hey, Zach. Pick a number from 1 to 100.
47.
27.
27. 27. He says.
Okay. I think he actually got. Okay, that's me. Okay, so I guess I take this one. All right, so I guess, let's see. We'll start from the lowest number, skipping me and Zach. I guess, Murat, this is a question for you. So it's going to be about, you know, political reform and stuff like that. So basically, I'm going to name a scenario, and you're going to say if violent basically what your preferred method of change would be in that situation, right?
Perfect.
So you kind of got the one I think we're in now, but basically you have a democracy, so it's something tyrannical, but it's in extreme gridlock, and it might be even corrupt. So it's basically nothing too out of the ordinary, but nothing's really being done. So
kind of like right now.
Kind of like right now,
where it's like on the cusp of becoming an what is it?
Fail state.
Would it be an oligarchy? Is that
Yeah. I suppose you can see
that. Would be I don't know if that's the correct pronunciation or expression to use. Authoritarian, borderline.
Yeah. Basically, it's nothing too extreme, but it's you're not going to be able to. Well, it's at least very hard to get through popular demands.
So. Okay, what's the question? How would I...
Basically, what's the preferred way? Is violent reform necessary? Or maybe not violent, but is out on the streets reform necessary? Basically, what you think is the proper course of action in that scenario? This is very subjective, obviously.
So violence or an alternative is the question.
Sure.
Sure, it could just be whatever you prefer in dealing with the situation.
I would say... whatever I actually prefer as me, I would say definitely somehow through means of education would be the most effective way to, and not religious education, but secular education is in the long term, that's the best way to alter something, in my opinion. I think, honestly, education is the answer to a lot of things. But if I wanted it to be such a rapid and radical change, because were there not a rapid or radical change, there would be some sort of catastrophic event. I would probably say that violence is a last resort, but maybe... If it were at the, I'm going to think about it in like a utilitarian sense, if this administration or oligarchy would cost the rest of the world, maybe the environment, or if they were causing trouble to countries that were not even a part of their country, and they were harmful to the earth and harmful to their own people, I think at a certain point you can use some sort of force. I don't necessarily want to say violence, but I think you can force them out of there.
So I like that example, actually. So if you had a gridlocked, corrupt, but overall functioning democracy that was not responding to, like, global warming, in that scenario, where it's kind of urgent, you would use force? Or some sort of,
I would say that you can, if there is actual evidence, not just like, we think that it's the so-and-so administration that's causing this problem. But no, if there's actual documented evidence, like they're spilling oil, or they're leaking radioactive waste knowingly, or something that is causing ridiculous amounts of harm, very understandably, and it's gotten to that dire point, I think you can use some force, in my opinion. I don't see why anyone wouldn't.
So is this force like protest force, or is it?
No, I think that in like the case of America, you would have Congress potentially. I don't know why I'm spacing this word. Not filibuster.
But you're still working within the system, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it should be done within the system. It's not as extreme as you said it is. This is just moderately heading towards the dire situation.
I'm thinking of like, okay, so how about if you were to take the BLM protest, for example, is that within the spectrum there? This gridlock hypothetical scenario, it sounds pretty much like the U.S. a little bit right now, maybe actually a little bit better if I'm being honest, but so like in this scenario, like would the BLM protests really exist, if I'm it's any sense?
Even in a country where speaking out might cost somebody their lives, there's always people protesting.
I think that's fair. Your scenario, your scenario is the most moderate, I think.
It is, I guess. I don't know the other scenarios, but it sounds like an understandable situation where.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds like most democracies overall. Honestly, I mean, most democracies do eventually get into a gridlock, sort of. At least American democracies. All right. I think I'm going to go with I think Sean's scenario is next.
Here, you should.
Yeah, let's do you take that one. Yeah, there you go. All right, Sean, your scenario of what you think should happen. Let's see. All right, so this is kind of like Murat's scenario, but it's a little bit slightly more extreme. Basically, the scenario is some sort of oligarchy or autocracy, something that's if you really want to go totalitarian, sure. A controlling state, but it's technically workable. Like you can technically participate in it. Maybe it might take a long time to participate in this government. It's not a complete exclusionist government, but it's also really strict in its laws or in its path forward, if that makes any sense. Think of, Iran, for example, right? Iran, okay. You can technically participate in their elections.
Or how about a monarchy?
A monarchy, if that's possible, if you can get to the top or at least somewhere close to the top. Yeah, monarchy works. Modern example, I guess Saudi Arabia might be an example if you're part of the family. So in that situation, where let's say you want to, there's a certain reform you want to do, but it's in that system. You know, what's your suggestion? Is it time to go violent? Is it extreme time or whatever?
Well, wouldn't it depend on what needs changing?
Yeah, and that's kind of, you know, you can have your own hypothetical reform idea. So if it's something that's like racial justice or actually, how about, I'm going to throw one at you. How about just global warming, and they're not doing anything about it, and you're in this situation? They being the government.
Well, that's a tough question. You know, my initial thought when you said a government in which you have some say in, but it's, even though it's autocratic, my initial thought was the ancient Greeks, oftentimes in times of trouble, in dire trouble, they would have a dictator take over the polis.
Yeah.
And he would generally form, even though the term wasn't used back then, a totalitarian government.
Yeah.
But in an ideal situation, he would step down. At that point, there was no possibility of a Xi, but he would step down when the danger was past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as far as something like global warming in our contemporary world, I still don't think violence will solve anything as far as global warming goes. Although you can take extreme nonviolent actions.
Uh-huh.
Marches. A lot of what they call extreme environmentalists basically use nonviolence to prevent forests from being abused or landscapes from being abused. I'm not sure, though, about the ocean. That's another problem, because you have a lot of renegades who are basically piratical in the way they fish beyond local laws or national laws pertaining to the ocean.
Yeah.
Now they're being subdued by military.
Wow.
Coast guards,
yeah,
right, and navies,
okay.
Which is a form of violence without violence, just by showing your strong arm and arresting them, it subdues them. So in that case, a certain amount of violence, or perhaps potential violence, the potentiality of violence, subdues a lot of environmental problems. But it all depends also on which side the government stands. In the United States right now, certainly our president is anti-environmental.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Which is, to me, absolutely frightening.
Yeah.
And therefore, he's put in power a lot of like-minded people who would readily abuse the environment for financial gain.
Yeah, I mean, most of the people in those departments probably don't even believe in clients, if I'm being honest. I think the guy he chose for the, I forget the name of the department, but you know, the environment.
Interior, I think?
Not the interior, the natural environment one. I used to know this. I forget.
Natural resources?
Whatever. I'm not sure, but basically the guy, I think the guy's name is Rick Perry. I forget. Basically the guy is like a climate change denier, and he put him like in that position and is like, well.
Doesn't believe in science.
Yeah, doesn't believe in science. Actually, that's exactly what it is.
Which is not a matter of belief at all.
Yeah, it's more ignorance.
It's not a matter of faith or belief.
Yeah, exactly. Which I think, actually, I'm glad you bring that up, because I think that's going to connect really well with the whole concept of theory and stuff and evidence-based stuff later on in the episode. But, so you're mentioning the, like, extreme Green Party people. Or not Green Party, but, like, Green people.
Yeah.
And there were
the greenies, I guess.
Yeah, greeners.
All the greenies.
You probably know the group. I forget the name of it.
I don't remember the name.
It was like an extremist, like, environmental protection group. It was like Green Thumb or something like that, or Tree Green. I forget. But they were pretty much classified as extremists, maybe even terrorists. I'm not even sure. But yeah, so I guess in certain situations, you know. You mean not violent?
Sabotage,
but
logging and the like.
Yeah.
Various means.
Yeah. So. Okay. So I guess you're, so in this scenario with the whole extremist but workable government. You're not saying work within the system, but you're basically just saying react hard but not violent hard.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense.
Nobody has to be hurt.
Yeah, okay. But you are saying that it's probably not going to get done within the actual government system.
Well, if you react in an extreme way but still without hurting anybody, it does get people's attention.
That's true, too.
So it depends on what you mean by violence.
Yeah.
Violence against people or violence against maybe sabotaging logging equipment?
Yeah, so what I mean violent, I do mean like bloodshed.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't necessarily
mean terrible. It depends on what you mean by Jesus.
That should be like on like that should naturally. But like, I'm not saying like terrorism in a certain sense where you like target in like innocent people, but
right.
violent as in just militants against like the government. But when you're saying sabotage, I think that's more like I suppose
damaging the material.
Yeah, damaging the material, non-violent extremist methods maybe. I'm not sure what the term would fit for that one.
Right. Yeah, it's like, there's a gray area in the term non-violence.
Yeah.
Because if I sabotage somebody's equipment, it's costing them monetarily.
Mhm.
Which is a form of violence.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
If I sabotage a tractor or a chainsaw,
mm-hmm.
That's a violent act. But it's not shedding bloodshed.
Yeah. Gotcha. Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's, the U.S., we're kind of at that point where it's damaging material, you know, stores, you know, Target and whatnot. That was being rioted against and stuff.
Hit people in the pocketbook and they'll change.
Yeah. yeah, sure. Okay, so, We went through two scenarios. We're going to go through so before we get into a song and then continue with the scenarios, we have Sean who's going to read a poem, just like last time. So what's the poem?
This poem is called Mock On, Voltaire, Rousseau by William Blake. He was born in 1757 and died in 1827. Very much a radical Christian. Some people like to consider him an atheist of sorts, but that's not the case at all. Anyway, mock on, Voltaire Rousseau by William Blake. Mock on, Voltaire Rousseau. Mock on, tis all in vain. You throw the sand against the wind, and the wind blows it back again. And every sand becomes a gem, reflected in the beams divine. Blown back, they blind the mocking eye, but still in Israel's path they shine. The atoms of Democritus and Newton's particles of light are sands upon the Red Sea shore, where Israel's tents do shine so bright.
We're back with our thoughts tonight. All right, so we're moving on with the game. All right, so Zach's on. Zach, say hi.
Hello.
All right, so I kind of explained to you in the break of kind of what you're doing, right? Okay. So I'm going to give you a scenario, right? So all I want from you is how do you survive in this situation in terms of, like, I guess political reform, I guess. All right?
Okay,
your scenario is this, and anybody can chime in as always. So you're in a democracy, right? You're kind of like in a good functioning society, democracy, people are participating, right?
Yeah.
But the trend is that extremists are becoming more and more they're more and more influencing the current government. They're more and more participating in within the actual society, basically. So your government system is all right. But you have a rise in active extremists. So what do you do against those extremists? What do you even do? Do you even do anything? So, yeah, that's my scenario. For the most part, but there is. Yes, but the people, in a good way. But there are some people who are influencing it in a bad way, or starting to.
In some way, shape, or form, by like doing things that are positive, not harmful, like giving inspirational speeches or like convincing people with some sort of activity or something. I don't know.
So you're saying set examples for people?
Yeah, set examples for people, I guess, is the best way.
Yeah. That's a good answer, yeah.
I don't know.
So, but what if you're late? What if you're late and these bad people get into the government and they're starting to change shit? What do you do then?
Rebel.
Are you gonna fight them?
Am I gonna fight them?
Are you gonna go violent? Dude. Congress is actually like a underground boxing arena. Pretty much is. Yeah. You know, some countries in like Africa and Europe, they literally get into fist fights in like their parliaments and stuff. Yeah, it's like little fights. There was one in, I think, Zambia, and like some guy like threw a chair. That might have been Ukraine, now that I think about it. Nah?
I'm so close to this.
Zach, you may want to talk louder then.
Hello? Can you hear me at all? Something's up with this thing. Oh, I can see it now. Look, it's going red. Is it supposed to go red?
I think you just need to talk louder.
Cable, man.
All right. We're having some technical issues. You know, our thoughts tonight. You know us. We'll be right back, though. Bye-bye. For now. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. Okay, so we're just gonna. I don't think you guys were able to hear Zach there. So we're just gonna. I just want you to quickly repeat your answer. So your scenario for political reform was good democracy with bad extremists.
Yeah.
What was your answer? What was your answer again?
Be level-headed.
Be level-headed.
And I think it was
And inspire people in a positive way.
Word. Okay.
That's it.
Okay. So cool. Okay. So. Okay, final scenario for this mini game, which is, yeah. So
if you did hear us a second ago and it sounded like Ushik was having a conversation with himself, it's because we had some technical difficulties. Because thanks to Zach, he's allowing us to use these awesome 1970s old talk show Johnny Carson style microphones, yeah. And one of them has a faulty wire.
Hey Johnny, what do you think about the new Back to the Future?
I'm gonna get the papers. Get the papers.
The new Star Wars movie. Anyway, wait, Sean, you were saying something.
I have an example of nonviolence being used to prevent violence, and that is the night that Martin Luther King, the night after Martin Luther King was assassinated, Robert Kennedy, I forget what city it was, I think it was Indianapolis. My younger sister just sent me a link to his speech, that it was very spontaneous speech.
Didn't he have? He quoted a Greek poet or something.
He did.
Right?
He did indeed. Yes. And after he gave the speech about Martin Luther King's death, which was news to most of his audience, and his audience was predominantly black, that was the only city of many major cities that didn't erupt in violence. And he preached compassion, understanding, and also love. So that is one example where nonviolence actually prevented violence.
What was the name of that poet? I can't remember.
I want to say Sophocles.
It was something like that.
Sophocles? Yeah, it was one of three. All right, I don't remember off the top of my head, but the three major Greek tragedians were Sophocles, Aeschylus, and Euripides. So my guess is it was probably Sophocles. After that, it might have been Aeschylus. Probably not Euripides, who had a more ironic and pessimistic view.
Yeah, probably not him. I think we're right. You're looking up, right?
Yeah.
I wish more kids these days had Greek names like that. That's great.
Sophocles, Socrates, yeah.
It's
Heraclitus.
Uncommon. It's uncommon.
That was his
name, right?
Aeschylus?
Yeah.
Aeschylus, okay.
It's a Greek version for Escalade.
Escalade, yeah.
I read about that recently. Oh, I read about that really recently. That's the only reason I know that. And he was saying, if I'm not mistaken, it's something along the lines of, I don't want to butcher it, but just about the horrors what is the word I'm looking for? the things we have to go through, essentially.
Oh, the struggles?
Yeah.
The struggle. Okay. Yeah, okay, that's fair. Ma'am. Trials and tribulations. Yeah. So that was what he was, the quote was about, or?
Yeah, actually it was, now I remember, Adam Neely mentions it in his new video about music theory is racist, is what the video is called, and how most, not music theory, as the arbitrary stimulus that of you know, lines and notes, but how 18th century music theory is kind of almost forced upon musicians globally nowadays. When I thought it was kind of outlandish myself, but I don't want to go ahead and say he was wrong, but like you have other types of music theories, like Indian music, that he uses that as an example, and they have their own modal system and their own articulations.
Out that Chinese opera is one of the oldest traditions in music.
Yeah, and you, I mean, in general practice, what he was saying is that these things aren't even mentioned almost, and we just use 18th century European music as the basis for
the main format.
Exactly, the main format, and it's not the format that's the problem. It's that when people become an elitist about that type of like that's the only way to be or whatever.
This way or the highway.
Yeah, it's a long video. He explains it much better, but he uses that Robert Kennedy quote. There's a Robert Kennedy quote in the beginning of the video. So if anybody wants to know what it is, don't listen to this. Go watch Adam Neely's new video.
Shut up.
So one last comment about Robert Kennedy's speech is what it indicates him quoting Aeschylus is how much we can learn from the old masters, that the old literature is not dead, that it lives with us today.
I mean, to be honest, society has been on Greek copy mode for like 2,000 years. So I mean, like it's really has been like that.
It's been on Greek copy mode.
Yeah, we're just copying the Greeks. Like
yeah, everybody copies the Greeks.
I mean,
or the Bible. Yeah, or the Bible.
Well, the Bible itself, I think,
the Bible
copied
probably copied
the Greeks.
Greeks.
Yeah.
A lot of the Bible came first.
Well, I mean, like at least like within my field of philosophy, it's like. It's just Plato and just Plato and just you just keep doing Plato as the philosophy is really pretty much was originally Plato. If you really want to go, yeah. Maybe some Aristotle in there, I guess.
Aristotle.
Aristotle. That's two. Yeah.
Well, the medieval mind would think Aristotle.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in certain sense, which side of the medieval world? I mean, before Aquinas, it was like Neoplatonist, and then like Aquinas gets some. Aristotle in there. Okay, never mind. And it's Aristotle all the way.
Boethius as well.
Boethius. I don't know Boethius, actually.
The Constellation of Philosophy.
Okay. Wow, I actually don't know this.
One of the most influential works in the Middle Ages.
Boethius. Does this person go by a different name by any chance?
It's a very long name, but it includes Boethius.
Okay, I'll have to look it up. I
Boethius is longer than his real name.
Yeah. Well, the thing is...
He was put to death in the early 6th century.
Early 6th century. Oh,
right.
Oh, that's like early.
Just after the fall of the Western Roman Empire.
Yeah, Middle Age philosophers are usually like underrated, in my opinion, because they usually are just Neoplatonists or Neo-Aristotelians or whatever. But yeah, I should look that up actually, Boethius. I think I'm gonna go through my last scenario, which I'm not really gonna leave it up to me because I don't want to be talking to myself.
Read it to you?
Huh? I kind of want to give it to everybody. I'll put in my own input, but so basically it's the same idea. Your scenario, what's the best course of action, but it's probably the most extreme route maybe. So you're already post-revolution. You've already completed your change, right? And in place is your provisional government. So the revolution's done and you have a provisional government who is setting the stage up for actual reform. The problem is they're really ineffective. They can't really do anything. It's post-revolution, so you know you already got rid of the bad government, so you kind of have at least some allies in the actual structure, but nothing's really going on. So what do you do in that scenario? Really quickly, my own option is just to keep going with the provisional government in a certain sense, because I mean I base this scenario off of like the Soviet system after the revolution. You have
the French Revolution as well.
The French Revolution, actually, yeah, pretty much most of, well, the violent ones at least. Yeah, you have a provisional government and it's pretty ineffective. But I feel like, at least with the French and the Russian Revolution, we view it as ineffective just because the extremists took over. So we just see, okay, the older one was ineffective. I mean, the Russian one was a little bit ineffective, but it could have worked if things didn't go too far south with the Bolsheviks taking over and various old monarchists returning. If that didn't happen, it would have been fine. That's my opinion. So I think, in my opinion...
So if the Germans had not allowed Lenin to return to Russia, things would have been different?
I think so. See, the one event that's kind of coming into my mind is when the provisional government in Russia took over, right, it wasn't really the Bolsheviks. It was like the social... what was it called? It's the social Democrats or whatever. Various different groups came in, right?
Under Kerensky, yeah.
And I think it was Petersburg that was sieged by an old monarchist dude, right? And in that hour of need, he called on the Bolsheviks. And that pretty much gave the Bolsheviks the opportunity to take over, right? So if that, for example, didn't happen, I kind of think it would have been mostly fine. Because the Bolsheviks were kind of a minority, right? Even when they did their own election, when they first took power, they lost. So in that sense, you know, it's all like luck, you know, the luck of the draw kind of thing. But in this scenario, I think it's totally reasonable to just keep going with the provisional government, although there are problems with, you know, what's the justification for having that government. But I kind of want to expand this to the other people of the podcast. Basically, what do you do in that situation? So.
That reminds me of kind of like the modern Turkish government prior to Erdogan. So you have Ataturk, or Ataturk, however you want to pronounce it, and he's just this revolutionary, you know, genius of a leader, war hero. And then for the rest of the 60, 75, 80 years, whatever the Turkish Republic is just nothing. They can barely even carry the vision because nobody can think like that. They don't have the Greek education that he had. They're just Turks.
Hey, man, come on.
They're just Turks. Yeah, that's a Turk saying that. And so they couldn't carry it because there was no revolutionary. And he did his best to get the, the society reformed. But, I mean, one man can only carry so much. People were just waiting for him to die, essentially, so they could, you know, carry that torch wherever they could take it. But you can't have anybody really carry that unless they think alike. So, again, I'll go back to my first answer. You have to educate the people on how to think as the revolutionary does.
I mean, it's funny you mentioned that because a big thing of Ataturk was education once he took power.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But I don't think he educated the people around him. This is my issue. I think that people looked at him, they were riding his coattails.
Yeah. I mean, the guy who succeeded him, Inonu. Well, yeah, that was his name, right? Inonu?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, so like, I can barely pronounce it myself, man.
Inonu. Yeah.
Inonu, right. All the Turks in the audience can probably correct this. But like, his whole thing, at least from what I can gather, was he was all right. He kept the country out of World War II and all that, but he wasn't like, he was kind of like a, you know, a step down, kind of like, eh.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that any of them had the level of education that Ataturk had. And like, it was okay, but it was kind of, what was the expression you used, that it was kind of stagnant and not powerful enough to carry this new reformed idea. And when you have an idea that is so radically different, you're going to have the people that were now pushed to the corner are going to be even more extreme. So you have to come back hard. You can't just do it half-assed. You have to be very deliberate about what you're doing, because the people that are against you are now very angry. And that's exactly what's happening. It took 80 years, but you have Erdogan, and he's totally reversing everything. It's not as – I think America's a little bit more volatile when you're coming to that argument, because you have the radical left. I don't want to say radical left, but you have like – it is kind of radical in concept that you have a black man as president, which is amazing. But then you've alienated the right, and they come back. They don't wait 80 years like the Turks, which can barely get off their asses. Apparently it takes them 80 years,
but they complain a lot
in 4 years with their version with Donald Trump. So
in that scenario, that's good law. That's a whole different issue. But yeah, in the Turkish sense, it's different. This is reminding me of Jefferson a little bit. And cause like, it's not exactly the same, but like Jefferson was, you know, what did he say? He was like, this country should have a revolution every like few years or something like that. He was like consistent reform or consistent like push. I mean, I think it was Jefferson. It might have not been Jefferson, but like, yeah, I'm if Mark can check that. Basically, if you put that into the Turkish context, we sort of did, but we sort of didn't, because Turkey is famous for its coups, right? After Turkey, it was like a bunch of coups. It was like coup is basically a takeover of the government from some whatever person or group, right? Kind of rebellion, but it's mostly just overnight. It's not like a long war. It's mostly like overnight, right? So Turkey is very famous for that. So we kind of had the counter movements, but most of them haven't been based off some sort of educational or academic background or some sort of like passion driven thing. It's mostly just been like
swift into the point,
and it's opportunistic. It's kind of the easy way out. It's not in terms of like, you know, massive change across society or, you know, going back to the Ataturk model, but it's mostly just, it's just playing politics in a violent manner in a certain sense. But, and then you have America, we've had that, but it's also, we haven't had the actual reform part of it. So really we are not, Turkey's not even really doing anything. We're just slowly falling back into pre-Ataturk times, which is sad if anything else, but. Did you find that?
Yes, my master.
Is this supposed to be Erdogan?
Yes, that's the real voice, the true voice.
I don't think we can go back to Turkey after this.
What was I supposed to look up?
Basically, which American, which I guess founding father or whatever said that we should have consistent revolutions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can we go into a poem and a piece here?
Sure, yeah.
We do this?
So we're going to go into a song. We'll probably just continue the Arabic song. Before we do that, Sean has another poem. I think it's kind of indicative of the topic that we'll explore post-song. So, Sean, what's going on?
So it's another poem by William Blake. It's a very famous poem called The Tiger, which I'm sure many listeners have read or heard. One thing to keep in mind, though, that I'm not sure everybody gets is, even though William Blake wrote the poem, he's not the narrator of the poem. So the question really is in this poem, what does the narrator think about the poem or think about the tiger as opposed to William Blake, the author? So the famous poem, The Tiger, by William Blake. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? Oh, what wings dare he aspire? What the hand does seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, in what furnace was the brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp, dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Oh, that was excellent.
Hallelujah.
We are back.
Hello. Yes, my master.
We are back, and I just want to I want to go ahead and advertise for Sean. He's got poetry up on allpoetry.com, and I think it's if you look up Sean R. Lyons, right? Sean R. Lyons on allpoetry.com. He's got a lot of original poetry on there. And and the hiking books. What was the name of the book? I can't remember. I'm sorry.
Guys, but you can
the Walkabout Guides.
You can find them on SeanLyonsBooks.com.
SeanLyonsBooks.com. And also on Spotify, iTunes, and all the other large music distribution formats. You can find Sean Lyons with Tradition in Transit. And the other album, which you called A Place with a View?
A Place with a View, right.
Yeah,
and that was just
music.
Numbers. But that never came out as an album.
Just okay, yeah. Just
a compilation of songs,
yeah.
Right. And I should also add one other thing, that if you go to SeanLyonsBooks.com, there's a number of articles that I used to write, that I wrote in the past for Anchorage Daily News about hiking in Alaska. Thanks, Morad.
Of course, yeah, we can't forget to do that.
Promotion. Be a, I'm gonna, yeah, never mind. this song ends. Also, you were mentioning, or you wanted to talk about something a while ago, or like.
Me?
Yeah. Did you want to still touch on that subject, or?
Yeah. Yeah, why not? Sure.
So what was it?
Yeah, I just want to double check our mic levels real quick. Two things, actually, that I did want to bring up. Excuse us for just a second. You know how it is. We're really with the low fidelity here at Our Thoughts Tonight. Can you speak into your mic?
Sure. I'm going to go ahead and take this opportunity to promote my own shit real quick. just because we're on local stuff, VAC, ARCH, Go For It, VACARC, streaming services, Bandcamp. You know what it is?
Okay.
I think we're good. All right, cool. So what are the two things that you want to mention after the two advertisements?
Okay. This first one is more short-winded than the other one. So I thought about it. I went to the John earlier to use the restroom. Yeah, and I thought about it. I've heard a lot of my dad complaining about Erdogan and the right-wing regime of Turkey currently. And you were just like, oh, we better be careful, you know, we might go back, and you know, it's getting dangerous. And it's like, you know what? No, because it took them 75 years to get their heads on straight, and they didn't realize that this could happen. Of course this could happen. So I don't blame Erdogan for what he's doing. He's just doing what it's not that what should have been done, because I'm never a fan of extreme religious government. I'm never a fan of religion at all. But they were being lazy, the progressives. They were being lazy and complacent, and that's what happened. They got their asses handed to them by somebody that was quicker and smarter and more religious than them. Plain and simple. Natural selection. And the Turkish people, they got played.
That's a tough thing to respond back to, because it's weird, because Turkey's a really weird country in terms of its population. It's extremely religious, but it's also extremely secular at the same time, right? So it's hard to, like, sure, it took 70... you know, years, but
no, they had 75 years to organize this shit, and they couldn't.
Well, the thing is, the secular country that Turkey is and was never the democratic leftist. It was always the strong leftist, which has a different connotation. As progressive as Atatürk was, he was militant and he was a strong man in a certain sense.
Yeah.
Turkey doesn't have a tradition of full on participatory, like, for the people democratic tradition. That's very rare, right?
That's what I'm saying, is that they had the foundation for that. They might have started from an extreme left point of view, but the difference is when I was okay. So before the I guess what is they're the AKP, right? The AKP, the Erdogan regime, before them. I mean, you used to drive down the road in Turkey, and there wasn't a single road that your tire couldn't potentially be hammered through a pothole with, you know. And then Erdogan and his regime take over, and economic growth is number one, it's paramount over anything else, and the roads get fixed. The people said, I mean, a lot of it was a lot of globalization suddenly, and for me, it was kind of weird. Because I was alive and in Turkey during prior to the Erdogan administration or regime, and it was way different. It was almost worse. It was like night and day. I mean, weeds everywhere. Roads weren't paved unless it was a main road, and if the main road was paved, there was potholes everywhere. Nothing was taken care of. So, to a degree, people are complaining that he's teaching religion in school. But I read something on Reddit the other day. It's like kids send their – or I'm sorry, parents send their kids to school and hope that the teacher teaches them what they didn't teach them. And then the parents send the kids home hoping – oh, no, the teachers send the parents – the kids home so that the – hoping that the parents teach them what the teacher didn't.
Yeah.
It's like – and then what happens in the end, the teacher doesn't – or the kids don't get taught.
Yeah.
And it's same situation here. It's just like, yeah. And they had the rug swept under them in terms of the Turkish society.
For most common day authoritarians, it always starts out with acceptable change. Putin's another example. Putin, when he came into power, was acceptable. He took care of the oligarchs. He did his thing. Adding a little bit of Chechen war stuff here and there,
mm-hmm.
and you kind of get stuff done, and then you do the gradual process of straight-out authoritarianism.
Yeah.
That same thing happened with Erdogan. It's
yeah, I remember yeah. when he was first in office. It was just like he was a normal dude.
Yeah, like maybe like center-right, but nothing crazy,
yeah.
right? Like, I agree with what you're saying, that they should have gone off their asses, but it's weird. So Turkey had the whole, the Turkish War of Independence, you had the whole establishment of a very progressive state, although by authoritarian means, in a certain sense, with Ataturk, right? And then you have like a long period of history where it's just strongman leaders cooing each other, right? And the biggest thing was like the War of Cyprus, right? Where it's just like, a military reaction. Turkey has, in its entire existence, post-Ottoman Empire, authoritarian, or I suppose democracy, flirting around with authoritarian for both parties,
yeah.
or both sides of society. So it's like, I don't want taking over and putting in the religious aspect of it. The religious aspect already existed in Turkey. Okay, like, for example, when Ataturk took over, there was an incident with, like, a Kurdish guy rebelling because of religious reasons. Like, because, like, Ataturk, he dismantled the caliphate. So there was a whole rebellion from Kurds. Like, oh, we should, reinstitute it, whatever. So there's always been a really, really conservative area of Turkey
yeah.
that was always there.
Yeah, the east.
Yeah, in the east.
Istanbul had enough weight to carry the left.
Yeah.
The thing is, also taking it in a geopolitical sense, Turkey didn't go through a World War II period. It was literally the
yeah.
same thing post-World War I.
Yeah, it's a bunch of dilly-dallying.
Dilly-dallying, because it's like countries in Europe, right? So you had... Let's say Germany, right? Post World War I, you had the Weimar Republic, right? Weak state, but overall democratic, right? Taken over by the Nazis, whatever. Post it, you have a democracy in the West, communism in the East. You have a certain sense of change in there, right? Which, on one side, is pushing democracy, right? But the weird part Turkey plays is, Turkey wasn't important for America and NATO because it was supposed to be democratic. It was important because of its geographic location,
mm-hmm.
right? So, and it's pretty much its resource. Like for America, America prefers a democratic Western Europe because it keeps its ideals, it keeps the same passion, in my opinion. But in terms of like the border states, it was like for Turkey and Greece, it was probably smarter to keep them authoritarian, and pro-NATO. Same with the South American countries. You don't elect a democratic country because they might elect leftists. You put authoritarians because they're on your side.
They keep them oppressed.
They keep them oppressed. But that's why Turkey is weird, because when it was left or when it was right, it was always consistently authoritarian in a certain sense. Like, because the Soviets didn't want them to be democratic with all the Soviet like sleeper cells or whatever that was in Turkey, because there was some leftist. I guess animosity in Turkey throughout its history, but also with the American side, they don't want it to be completely democratic because the authoritarian side is on their side. So Turkey was almost always forced into that authoritarian area, even though it was considered the only democracy in the Middle East for a little bit. But I mean, nowadays, what do you even do?
It's become like a hegemony from each different, variation of progressive and now eventually right. But I guess that was supposed to be not long-winded.
That was a short topic, yeah.
But I was going to say, the last thing is like about the kids going to school is that, you know, so now there's the issue of Islam being taught in school or whatever. Teach your fucking kid at home. Teach your kid how to be a decent person, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he learns Islam at school. It doesn't. Teach him morality on your own. Don't be such a lazy motherfucker and give them an iPad and just let them roam the internet. Like, if you're so worried about your goddamn kid learning Islam in school, get the iPad out of their hand when you take them out. Show them how to observe nature and society for themselves.
But isn't... I mean, I'm not a religious person by any means. But
none of us are, right?
Right. But even if you teach a child Islam or Christianity, if it's taught in its ideal sense, you're teaching morality.
Yeah,
because
when
you're right, you're right down to the basics of most major religions. They teach compassion, acceptance, and nonviolence.
Unfortunately, we're not talking about pure Islam or pure Christianity. It's a diluted government instrument masquerading as Islam.
I understand that. Right.
If it was taught truly the way it was meant to be learned, it would be peaceful in most religions, I would assume.
I mean, it's interesting because if Turkey took the moral route of Islam path, it would actually carve out a very unique path, right? Because you have like the whole Shias in Iran with their own version, and you have the extremist Sunnis in Saudi Arabia. If Turkey would continue with its secular version of Islam, as it did in one way or another with Turkey and whatnot, it would actually go to many places. It would go to places. You know what I mean? I mean, let's be honest. Like the reason why Erdogan's doing that is, I mean, it's so obvious. It's just neo-Ottoman Empire stuff. Like the involvement in Syria, the current involvement in Libya, this current oil-like competition going on in the Eastern Mediterranean between Turkey and Greece. You have like the entire Middle East, France, and Libya within it too. It's this whole ordeal. You have extreme, conservative Islam being taught in schools and stuff like that. It's just, if anything, the guy just has a fantasy dream of like being a sultan or something.
Sultan, yeah, with the concubines and blah blah blah. Yeah,
yeah, I mean, maybe that's stretching it, but like it's
that's what
it seems like.
can I hammer a cog into these wheels? Most people tend to forget that news in itself or our interests are incredibly local. And so if somebody, getting back to Murat's comment earlier, somebody fixes the potholes in the street, we're very happy. And that's, for a lot of people, that's sufficient. We don't care who the government is. If they fix the potholes or they put food in our plates, if the economy is good, we're happy. Getting back to Weimar. Right? Hitler comes to power, he makes Germany's economy bubble again.
Yeah.
He puts food in every plate, and people will turn a blind eye to the brown shirts wandering the streets late at night as long as they have the potholes fixed, food on the table,
absolutely.
And the economy's good.
Exactly, and that's why Erdogan is still in power. But, I mean, the only reason I brought that up is not because of my short-sightedness towards that, but the fact that the government prior to the Erdogan administration or regime, whatever you want to call them.
It's a regime.
They were – so Erdogan stealing money, siphoning from the country. And at least he's providing the streets without potholes. The government's prior – they weren't even doing that. They were just siphoning the money.
Well, the thing is, that was past Erdogan. Current Erdogan, again, Turkey's going through an economic like depression right now. Coronavirus,
yeah.
Or even before it, the Turkish lira is like falling. It's been falling for years, right? So, but
now even more so.
Well, in the past, it was kind of like good in a certain sense. It was Turkey was surviving and it was on the up, right? Istanbul was like the whole bridges and stuff. Like, it was good, right? But still, Erdogan still has power, and I feel like honestly. People have just given up in Turkey.
The Turkish lira is dying.
It's dying. It's especially now with coronavirus and stuff. It's Yeah, it is. And the thing is, I think, you know, I don't know if you guys know, but the whole like oil situation. So there's a little patch of oil in like the Eastern Mediterranean, right? And it's technically, it's complicated. I'm not trying to go too super in detail with this, but Cyprus is incredibly important right now because of that, right? Because Cyprus is technically not divided, but practically divided, right? If you go through United Nations laws, Cyprus, the actual country of Cyprus, owns that patch of oil. And Cyprus has great relations with Greece. But if you go by Turkish standards with northern Cyprus, Turkey has the patch in a certain sense. And it's important because that pathway leads to Libya, currently in civil war. Both sides supported, one side supported by Turkey and the U.S., other side supported by France and extremist governments. It's complicated, right? But the point is, Turkey economically is falling apart. They kind of need that oil, right? That's what they're thinking. Yeah. They need the intervention in Libya. They need influence around other countries, right? I'm not sure how that's going to help their lira, but
like, I wish I wasn't here.
Yeah. It's kind of complicated. But the advantage Erdogan had with economic, like, you know, providing to the local man, is gone. It's no longer here. But even though it's gone, he still has control, because I just flat out believe that people have just given up. How do you even deal with it?
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know. Matter of time.
Well, it's weird, because one thing that Erdogan is almost universally liked upon in Turkey, at least from what I can gather, is his geopolitical moves, right? The left, again, this is because Turkey, in left or right, is always authoritarian. Whatever side you choose is always authoritarian. Both sides prefer, they're both sides are like, F Europe, I don't care about Europe, F
well,
the
no,
EU.
Before that, everyone was peddling their ass to clean up so they could join the EU.
Yeah. Now both sides are like, F it, right? Both sides are saying F it. Both sides are kind of nudging with Russia a little bit. Both sides also are nudging with America.
The EU is wasted anyway, man.
I mean, in a certain sense, they're right. Well, locally there is a left and right side. Mm-hmm. Geopolitically, they're on the same side.
Yeah.
They're geopolitically, they just want Turkey strong. That's pretty much it, right? Which is, and I feel like Erdogan's playing his pieces a little bit correctly, because in a certain sense it's kind of united. What is that?
That's big cricket.
Erdogan's taking over. I mean, this is just my, you know, inexperienced position on this, but it's like, I don't kind of playing his pawns correctly. He's...
I agree. I don't have experience in this situation.
I don't know shit, man. I'm white from America.
He's... By the way, Zach, if you want to talk, let me know so I can end this mic.
I got a loud voice.
I'm a loud speaking man.
So the other thing I was going to mention is not important, because I was going to say... I was saying that it's more... less and less common, more and more uncommon to see level-headed people. But based off of this conversation, I don't sound level-headed, so I don't want to sound like a hypocrite. We have, do you have another poem, Sean? All right. We can do, we should do another poem, come back and chat for a bit.
Sure, how much time we have?
20 minutes. And I feel like if we want to keep it going, we could just open up another episode if we really wanted.
Okay, so how long is the next song? Is that 6 minutes? I think Sean's song?
Yeah.
Okay, so right now we have a poem from Sean. He's going to read his poem, and then we're going to go into a song from his, actually. So, Sean, if we can introduce your song once you're done, so we can...
What is my song?
Oh, it's a Fantasy in E minor. Okay. And you, if you want to say something about the piece before the poem, however you... Or after, whatever.
I'll do it after the poem.
Okay.
So this poem is by an American poet. So we're switching from William Blake to Archibald MacLeish. Born in 1892, died in 1982. It's called The End of the World. Quite unexpectedly, as Vassaro, the armless ambidextrian, was lighting a match between his great and second toe, and Ralph, the lion, was engaged in biting the neck of Madame Sosman while the drum pointed and Teeny was about to cough. In waltz time, swinging Jocko by the thumb, quite unexpectedly, the top blew off. And there overhead, there hung over those thousands of white faces, those dazed eyes. There in the starless dark, the poise, the hover. There with vast wings across the canceled skies. There in the sudden blackness, the black pall of nothing, 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 nothing at all.
What you want to talk about?
Let's talk about something.
Talk about something?
We'll talk about the song.
Talk about the song. Oh, so Murat is attempting to upload. He's attempting to upload a Fantasy in E minor, which I wrote, and I'm dating myself
sounds
extremely,
beautiful.
Back about 1975 or 76. My first guitar. And I first started composing pieces in notation as opposed to just playing a piece and trying to remember it. I was actually writing it out on staff, G-Club staff. And the album that I put out soon after contained a number of pieces similar. The first piece I ever put on notation was called Dance for Two Seasons, that I wrote for a couple of friends of mine who were getting married. So this goes back a long way.
How long?
Oh my gosh, Zach. I was just graduating college. And the album was produced a few years after that. You know, I'll tell you honestly, I'm 65 years old now, so that goes back 45 years.
Dang. We got 40 years on you.
when I moved to the great beyond,
hopefully,
whatever great beyond there is.
So it's still uploading currently, but a minute or two. I don't know why it didn't show up. Anything else you can tell us about the album in case people listen? Or?
From the fact that I just become my teacher, Phil DeFarmy, in chamber music. And so I was very interested in imitation as a form of composition. And that would be interesting in the end is a form of imitation. I won't say that by any means I even come close to the hem of his skirt, but the idea of listening to his fugues and listening to his imitative works inspired the introduction of this piece.
Excellent. Well, Bach is great. That's all anyone needs to know.
One killer,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Bach, Brahms, and Beethoven.
Yeah, the triple B. Or in any genre, I think. And I could only choose either the Beatles or Bach. Or the two. Yeah, the four Bs. We've got we're here at 74%. So the. Fantasy will be up in just a moment.
What is culture and music in common?
What's that?
They both like Bach.
I guess so.
No, Bach, Bach, Bach.
Oh, yeah.
Off of,
got him. Yeah.
Baklava. Baklava.
That's Mozart.
Yeah.
We call it after the tune?
Well, I'm going to ask again. How long?
Now we have 13 minutes before we play the
well,
piece.
I guess we should probably call it a. But so I feel a little bit bad because we didn't get to one of the parts I was going to talk about, but I think it's okay. Yeah, we will. Part two we'll discuss. I might be though.
Stay tuned.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we can actually continue this for a different day, but yeah. It, just in case we don't, even though I do kind of want to, we can touch on this idea of.
We can talk, and then we could do the piece. How about that?
Okay, sure.
We close maybe, out with the piece.
I guess that's fair. Well, I suppose the main thing was right. Was theory, right? And because because this episode has been mostly about politics, we can stick to politics, right? Like, for example, I'm going to bring up the Turkish situation again, right? You know, I suppose with the Turkish situation, in that example, using some sort of theory, political theory, would probably help out a lot. Because honestly, it seems to be that Turkey has been on, like, you know, impromptu... you know, just go along with the flow, whatever you feel like mode. I don't know. This is a 6-minute discussion on this, and this is a very complicated topic. But, talk to me. Like, a political theory in the Turkish situation, would it be useful? Because I just think, like, Turkey has been, just been doing whatever it just wants, depending on whichever prime minister or president has been in power. Or is that just a one-off case? I don't know if that makes any sense. But
how about a philosopher king in the tradition of Plato?
Well, honestly, I think Plato only said that because he himself was a philosopher. But that's idea. See, now that's
Aristotle, the same idea. A philosopher might make the best king.
Yeah, I mean, that's. I agree. I think the main point of that is just an educated leader, right? In a certain sense, and you know, I guess in their context, it is theoretical because it wasn't really the norm. But nowadays, you can absolutely have an educated leader. It's very common nowadays, if anything.
Poland.
Do they have a?
After the fall of communism.
Was there a leader that was
Oh my gosh, I can't remember his name, but he was a poet.
Really?
Yeah. Or he was also a leader in labor. Oh, my gosh. I can't remember his name. I'm sorry.
I'm not sure who it is, but I do know that Poland after communism.
Zach dying here, man.
I don't know, man. Is Poland, like, really funny?
I don't know what you asked him. He said, I said, but did we what? He's like, Poland,
yeah. Well, I don't know about a leader, but I do know that Poland after communism has really went strong in its politics. I mean, partly it's the center of the EU, apart from Germany. It's Poland's playing it strong right now. And I'm sure it's because of that leader, but
any final thoughts for our thoughts tonight, everyone?
Bangang.
Of course.
I'm gonna it's a paraphrase of William Blake. I don't have it exact in my head, but what did he say? He said, "I must create a system of my own or be enslaved by another."
I'm just gonna say that. The world is technically anarchy. Anarchical. What am I even trying to say? My point is I'm okay with extreme reform. I think we're in a time where stress and stagnation are at a tipping point. I think that better get violent reform done now or it's going to be more than what we can expect. I just think that... I think the world is bored. I just think the world is bored. Yeah.
Upward and onward. Here we go. Fantasy in E minor, ladies and gentlemen. Have a good night.
Our boss tonight.